Okay, we're concluding Pasuk Yud, where David had passed away, by Yikaver Be'ir David, and he was buried in Ir David on Har Tzion. Pasuk Yud Aleph, V'hayomim Asher Malach David Al Yisrael, and the days that David ruled over Kal Yisrael, Arbaim Shana, add up to 40 years, B'chevron Malach Shabashanim, in Chevron he ruled for 7 years, Over Yerushalayim Malach Shloshim B'Shalosh Shanim, and Yerushalayim he ruled for 33 years. Because we had mentioned, referenced this in the past, that when David first became king, he was not accepted by all of Kai Yisrael, only by Shevet Yehuda, Binyamin, etc. And it was only 7 years later, when a deal was worked out with Avner, that all of Kai Yisrael accepted David as king, and then he moved the capital to Yerushalayim. The Chazal go through the Cheshbon, and you actually find that there's a half a year missing. When you go through the timetable mentioned in Sefer Shmuel and you add it all up, it was really 40 and a half years. And of course, the simple pshat is that the pasuk isn't counting fractions. And some of the Mefarshim do say that. That will be Abderach HaPshat, that it's 40 full years plus change. And that the pasuk doesn't go into such detail. However, Chazal have an interpretation to explain this on a deeper level, and they say that there was a 6-month period that David HaMelech had tzara'as. After the Chet of Basheva, part of his kapara was that he was afflicted with tzara'as for 6 months, and during that time he was not able to rule, because a mitzora has to be chutz l'machane and can't be involved. So although from the beginning of his rule to the end of his rule is 40 and a half years, right? But only 40 years of that time was he actually the king. The 6 months that he had tzara'as did not count. During that time was the time period that David HaMelech composed Kapitel Vav of Tehillim, Sefer Tehillim, which we are all familiar with. I don't know if you know that it's Kapitel Vav, but that's the Kapitel of Tachnun. Hashem Alba Abcha Tochicheni, which we say, I was going to say every day, but that's not quite true. Sometimes for Tachnun. I do recall a situation one summer. I was davening in a certain minyan, Mincha. I used to daven Mincha in the shul, and they didn't say Tachnun. So I thought, you know, that was their minhag. They don't say Tachnun by Mincha. I was there for about 2 weeks when suddenly they're saying Tachnun. So I went over to the gabbai and I said, how come we're saying Tachnun? He says, why not? So I've been here for 2 weeks. It's the first time we're saying Tachnun. He says, well, that's because yesterday was so-and-so's yard site, and today was so-and-so's yard site, and this was that. Today there's no yard site, so why shouldn't we say Tachnun? So I guess I can't say every day. But Tachnun is this Kapitel Vav that was composed during the Tzara'as, and if you take a look at it and see the meaning of it, you will see the relevance. He talks about Refein Hashem Ki Umlalani, and he talks about the embarrassment, and the enemies, certainly you can imagine that David's enemies picked on this. So you'll understand perhaps a little more the meaning of Tachnun. By the way, Derech Agav, Tachnun is somewhat abused, probably because two things it has going against it. First of all, it comes after Shemoneh Esrei, when we could already see the doorway. You know, people are edging towards the doorway. And secondly, because sometimes we talk, don't say Tachnun. So people are mezalzel, but the power of Tachnun is a phenomenal tefillah. And the reason why you put your head down during Tachnun, because that's the moment that you could pour out your heart. Any tzoros that a person has, any difficulty, any pain, the time to express it is during Tachnun, as David expressed his pain of the tzara'as. And we had actually mentioned this story in a different context, but when Rabbi Elazar was put into cherem by his brother-in-law, Rabbi Gamliel, so Rabbi Elazar's wife, Rabbi Gamliel's sister, used to disrupt Rabbi Elazar whenever he said Tachnun. And one time she failed to do so, either the two versions in the Gemara, either because she thought it was a 2-day Rosh Chodesh, there was no Tachnun, and actually it was only a 1-day Rosh Chodesh and there was Tachnun, or because an ani, a poor person, came to the door just at that moment when Rabbi Elazar was about to say Tachnun and she didn't get back in time. So when she saw that he had said Tachnun, she said, "Oh, my brother Rabbi Gamliel has passed away." And they found out at that moment he passed away. Why he passed away is a different story. We discussed it once. But the point is that when the expression of pain during Tachnun has that impact. And Tachnun is a very special tefillah. So that was this is now officially the end of the Tekufa of David HaMelech, and now begins the rule of Shlomo HaMelech. The pasuk says, Shlomo yashav al kisei David aviv, Shlomo sat on the throne of David his father, vatikon malchuso ma'od, and his kingdom was very well established, firm, secure. It's hard to give a precise translation. What is the meaning of this expression, Yashav al kisei David aviv? He sat on the throne of Kal Yisrael. Why is it referred to as the throne of David aviv? And Mefarshim say that this implies that he acted like David. Like the throne, it's not the physical seat that makes the throne. It's what you do with it, how you behave. He sat on kisei David aviv means that he was a continuation of David his father. And just as David conducted the melucha b'tzidkus, with righteousness, so too did Shlomo. One might derive from there the implication that there's a connection from the first part of the pasuk to the last. Shlomo yashav al kisei David aviv, and therefore batikon malchusomo. That's why his kingdom was very secure. As David himself said to him in the beginning of this parak, that if you follow the Torah and follow the ways of Hashem, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu will secure your throne. So what does it mean by Tikon Malchusom Ma'od, that his kingdom was very secure? The implication is that there is something in Shlomo's kingdom beyond that which we had in David's kingdom. So one pshat, I guess, again, Al Piderech HaPshat, a simple explanation would be that David took 7 years before he was able to establish his rulership over all of Kaisel, as the last pasuk says, Sheva Shana Malach V'Chevron, and then Yerushalayim. Whereas Shlomo immediately stepped into a secure kingdom. So Vatikom HaFesom Ma'od, that he didn't have to fight political battles or military battles to establish his kingdom, it was already well established. Additionally, Mefarshim say that there was a difference between David's kingdom and Shlomo's kingdom, in that although David had the throne, he always, not always, but he had occasional challenges to the throne. You had Absalom's rebellion, you had Sheva ben Bichri, you had Adoniyahu really at the end of his life. So there were periods during David's kingdom where his authority was being challenged, besides the first 7 years where he didn't have a full kingdom. Shlomo never had such a thing. Shlomo's kingdom was well established, and there was never any challenge to Shlomo throughout his melucha. So therefore we use the expression of Atikon Malchusom Ma'od. Although David in the end ultimately prevailed and for the most part controlled the country, but there were challenges. Rashi says a very interesting thing, a little one-liner, Atikon Malchusom Ma'od Af Al Ha'Elyonim. Shlomo's kingdom was very well established, even on the Elyonim, the inhabitants of the upper worlds. There are all kinds of stories about Shlomo HaMelech, with all kinds of mystical, magical things. I don't know exactly, some of them are based in Chazal, some are not. I don't know where they all come from. But without getting too esoteric, I think there is a basic, we don't really do Kabbalah here in this year, but there is a basic principle that even us non-Kabbalists can appreciate, which is that anything we do below has an effect in the worlds above. And there is a concept that we have a certain control over the upper worlds. But this depends on how we behave and what we do. Shlomo mastered this, so to speak, form of behavior to such an extent that one could say that he ruled al yonim, that he had a certain control, obviously not to the exclusion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself, but it's feasible to say that Shlomo is a melech al yonim, because his influence and control over the malachim and over the heavenly beings was the relationship of a melech to his subjects. So Shlomo had this accomplishment, power, whatever it may be, that apparently surpassed even that of David HaMelech, because Rashi is commenting on the same expression, but Tikon Malchuso Ma'od. Right, the Kli Yakar suggests that there is another connection between the first part of the Pasuk and the last part of the Pasuk. We had mentioned before on the simple level that since Shlomo followed in the footsteps of David, he was also to see out the Deshmaya, and therefore Vatikom Malchuso Ma'od. The Kli Yakar suggests that there was a very practical consequence. Shlomo sat on the throne of David, meaning while David was still alive. And that's how he interprets Kisei David Aviv. Once David passed away, it's not Kisei David. So he's saying that the fact that Shlomo was installed as king while David was still alive made it easier for Shlomo to control the Malucha, because everyone knew that David wanted him to be king, and therefore Vatikon Malchuso Ma'od, that gives him a special power to be able to really establish his kingdom to a much greater level than would have happened had he followed in the normal course of events and not taken over the throne until after David died. And he gives a parallel. The parallel is Yahushua. Yahushua was appointed the leader of Kal Yisrael while Moshe was still alive. And Moshe himself was Samach Yado Alav, and as Chazal say, that Yahushua darshaned while Moshe was alive, so people shouldn't say, Kozman, that Moshe was alive, Yahushua didn't open his mouth. So, as a result of that, Yahushua had a greater control and a greater melucha than he would have had otherwise. So in a similar way, Shlomo benefited by being installed in the throne by David while David was still alive. The next segment is Adoniyahu's fatal mistake. Before we read the psukim inside, just a little bit of an overview and introduction. What's going to happen is Adoniyahu is going to approach Bathsheba, Shlomo's mother, and ask for permission to marry Avishag. His intent apparently is to try to lay the groundwork to make another claim at the throne, because Avishag had served the king, and there is a rule that anything that was used by the king cannot be used by a hedyot, by a plain person. And by taking Avishag as a wife, he was attempting to establish his credentials as a melech. We'll see as we get into the psukim a little bit what his particular arguments were. Why did he go to Bathsheba and not to Shlomo? So I think we could all understand the strategy. He knew that if he went to Shlomo, it wasn't going to go. But Bathsheba, you could persuade a woman a little more easily. I hope this is going to be on tape. We may have a problem. But, appeal to her emotions, to her feelings. It's possible sometimes to persuade her. And Adoniyahu was certainly a very persuasive individual. The fact that he was able to attract such a following in his original rebellion. All right, so Yoav and Avyasar we could explain, but he had many of the sons of the Melech and many of the people. So he was a charismatic, as we would say today, charming figure. And Bathsheba would not be as alert and not be as hostile as Shlomo would be. He was hoping if he could win over Bathsheba, and Bathsheba approached Shlomo, Shlomo's guard wouldn't be up. Right? If he came, Shlomo would view everything with suspicion. It came from his mother. Perhaps Shlomo would fall for it. It didn't quite work. Shlomo did not fall for it, and as a result of this, Shlomo ordered eventually the execution of Adoniyahu.
What would he gain by marrying?
Okay, it's not clear from the psukim exactly what his strategy was. There's two really, I think, fundamental questions that need to be answered. One is, it's clear from the psukim that this was a strategy. Marrying Avishag was a means to get to, how does A get to B? And that's just because you married Avishag, so how is that going to get the throne for you? And the second question is, If everybody knew that you're not allowed, a hedyet is not allowed to use the sharpet hamelech, what was his argument to Bathsheba? How did he fool Bathsheba? She was presumably aware of the very fundamental basic rules of melucha, and why would she go for it? So there is a the Malbim explains the strategy of Adoniyahu, a very clever strategy. He has to come up with a cover story, some excuse as to why he's allowed to marry Avishai. But assuming he gets away with that, what would he say? His argument was going to be that Avishag did not serve David HaMelech until David was already old, right? And the story was David was old, he was cold, he couldn't keep warm, they got Avishag. Today we have these types of discussions based on current events in Eretz Yisrael. What happens when the leader of a country is no longer capable of fulfilling his function? Is a melech who cannot act as a king, is he still a king? So the rules of Malucha apply. So the strategy of Adoniyahu was to get some excuse, we're about to marry Avishag, and then to go around and say, now what's going on here? Why did Shlomo allow me to marry Avishag? She's a Shavat HaMelech. She was used by the king. We all know the answer. Because David wasn't really a king anymore. David was not functioning. You know, the kingdom was being manipulated behind the scenes. You know, Nasan HaNavi and Tzadok HaKohen and Benaiah Ben Yehoyada, you know, maybe Shlomo himself. They were really running the show. David was incapacitated, was incompetent, and was not able to be a king. And that's why Avishag is not ushered to me. But for that very same reason, the appointment that David made to Shlomo was also not valid. David made a public announcement that Shlomo should be king. If David were in full control of his faculties and was really a melech, of course I would abide by that decision, as we all would. Because we all want to follow David's ratzon. But David really wanted me to be king. And when he was old and feeble and incompetent, so the powers behind the throne had their own motives in mind, manipulated the situation. Araya, they themselves know it's true. If it wouldn't be true, why would they allow me to marry Avishag? So this was his strategy. He was going to try to marry Avishag and then challenge the appointment of Shlomo as king. And he was hoping he'd get some support and get a following, and then he'd be able to mount the challenge to the throne. So this, according to the Malbim, was this wasn't the Malbim, this is the Musa HaNeviim. Say from Musa HaNeviim, was the reason why the strategy whereby he hoped to obtain the throne. By the way, we'll wait till we get to the part, but an indication that Adoniel himself knew that his arguments were not valid, and was really in a sense evident that his arguments were not valid, though he fooled Bathsheba, was the fact that Avishag didn't go home. Why is, if he wants to marry Avishag, he should be, you know, calling up Avishag's father, you know, getting the shadchan, whatever it is, and making arrangements. Why is he going to Shlomo HaMelech? The answer is because Avishag didn't go home. Avishag stayed in the king's palace, was being supported by the king, and stayed in the... Why? Because she was a Shavat HaMelech, she couldn't go home. So that is clearly the reason why she was there. But, you know, with a good argument, you could sort of, you know, cover over the facts, and that's exactly what Adoniyahu did. Now, as you go through the psukim, we will see, again, that you read these psukim sometimes, they seem like a simple narrative, but this is, in Navi, nothing is there for no purpose. Each pasuk develops the strategy of Adoniyahu, which was a very profound and clever strategy. And of course, stage one of the strategy did work. He was able to get Bathsheba on his side. But stage two, which Adoniyahu could not control that well, he could not exactly tell Bathsheba what to say. And as we get there, we'll see that perhaps Bathsheba said some things which Adoniyahu would not have said. He would have said it differently. It didn't quite work to fool Shlomo. So let's take a look. Pasuk Yud Gimel. Vayavo Adoniyahu ben Chagis el Bathsheba. Adoniyahu ben Chagis comes to Bathsheba, aim Shlomo, the mother of Shlomo. Vaytomer, and she said, Hashalom Bo'echa, did you come in peace? Vayomer Shalom. He says, yes, I came in peace. Now, this sets the stage. We said before that he was afraid to go to Shlomo because he knew that Shlomo would be suspicious and probably would see through his argument. Well, Bathsheba is also suspicious. Bathsheba says, Hashalom Bo'echa. It doesn't take Shlomo to be suspicious. I mean, you were trying to fight against Shlomo, now you're coming to me like, what's this all about? So Bathsheba also starts off suspicious, and we'll see what Adon Yahu did to try to allay those suspicions. Now, the expression Aim Shlomo, Bathsheba, the mother of Shlomo, we obviously know that he's the mother of Shlomo, she's the mother of Shlomo. But this refers back to what we mentioned before, alluding to a strategy. The reason why he came to Bathsheba was to use her position as the mother of Shlomo to fool Shlomo. That Shlomo would not be on guard when talking to his own mother, and that's exactly the reason why Adonio is picking this particular strategy. Now, what was Bathsheba suspicious of? What was she afraid of? Hashalom Bo'echa. If the answer would have been no, what would that answer have been? She was clearly afraid that Adoniel wanted to challenge the throne. And the Mefarshim, some of the Mefarshim say, Kliyokar, and others say, the expression by Yavai Adoniel ben Chagas implies that he came barging in, like in a Bahala, in a rush, precisely to fuel those suspicions. He appeared agitated. Came in agitated, upset, angry, even Bahala, I have to speak to you. In order to build up her suspicions. Why? Part of the psychological strategy. If somebody comes to you and you're expecting the guy to make a huge, major claim, and all he asks is for something minor, you're very relieved, and you're much more inclined to grant the request. You know, the guy's coming in, he's been arguing with you about some $1 million deal, and he comes storming in, I gotta speak to you. And so, here he is, he's gonna fight with me about $1 million. And he says, you know, the other day I laid out, $10 to buy a thing for the company, I was never reimbursed. I wanna get my $10 back. Oh, sure, here you go. No problem. Forget about the receipts, forget about the what it was for, no questions. Because I'm very relieved, that's all you're asking. So that's what part of the strategy that Daniel employed. He came in, Vayavu in a Bahala, get Bathsheba all nervous, Hashalom Bo'echa, Batomer Shalom, and then when it turns out he's not asking for the Melucha, all he wants to do is marry Avishag, she's relieved that it's a minor claim, and you have more of a tendency to agree. But Daniel plays his hands very well. Next pasuk. Vayomer, he says, Dover li eilayach, I have something to say to you. Vatomer daber, so he says, speak. So he doesn't say what he's coming for right away. I need to talk to you. He already said, Shalom bo'echa, so he could have said right away, Shalom, I want to ask this and this and this. No, he pauses and waits. So the suspense builds. She still doesn't know what he wants. So she said, okay, speak. Vayomer, and he says, At yadat, you know, ki li haisa hamalucha, that the kingdom was mine. V'alai samu kol Yisrael p'nei limach, and all the Jewish people were looking to me to rule. V'atisov hamalucha, and the kingdom was turned aside. V'atihi la'achi, and it became my brother's. Because Hashem wanted him to be the king. So here too, again, he starts off his claim as if he is claiming against the Melucha. But then he turns around and says, but Hashem wanted it. Obviously it was Min Hashem. Let me read the two psukim together and we'll explain it. Now, She'ela Achas Anochi Shoel, but I do have one request, Me'itcha, Al Toshibi Espan, I don't turn me away. And he still doesn't say his request. V'tome'ela Daber. So what was this argument? So on its surface, it would appear counterproductive. Okay, he's building up the suspense and the nervousness and so on. But how is he going to extricate himself from this? I think the kingdom belongs to me, and everyone wanted me to rule, and Hashem took it away from me. How is that supposed to persuade Bathsheba to give him his request? So here's where the Malbim comes in. The Malbim explains that the argument that Adoniel was making was that there is no need to worry about Sharvet HaMelech. Of course, he didn't say his request yet, but it will become apparent in a moment. And he was saying as follows. Why is it that a hedged is not allowed to use the items of the king? It is to protect the power and the dignity and the covet of the king. But where a king needs no protection, it's not necessary. And actually, the Malbim quotes a halacha, interestingly enough, there's no din of Sharvet HaMelech, so to speak, by a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Something that was used for Hektish, if it's redeemed, can be used for Chulin. And the fact that it was used for the Melech, Malchei HaMelechim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, doesn't instigate a halacha that a hedge is not allowed to use it. This is why? Because nobody could threaten the throne of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't need such protection. So, Adoniel was arguing, look what happened here. This does not follow the norms of political history. I deserved the throne. I was the oldest brother. I had the support of the people. I had the rulers. I had the leadership. I had the followers. I had everything. And in one second, it was all taken away from me and given to Shlomo. It's self-evident and obvious. Ki me'ashem ha'isazos. What kind of fool could possibly challenge the Maluch of Shlomo? It is so obvious that it did not follow the rules of nature that his kingdom is secure. There's nobody in his right mind who could think that anybody could challenge the throne of Shlomo. So if that's the case, what do you need these little petty rules about Shavuot HaMelech, not Shavuot HaMelech? It's not necessary. It's self-evident that everything came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Of course, this is the kind of argument that Bathsheba would like to believe. Right? Appealing on emotions that it secures me, Hashem, nobody's challenging it. The fact of the matter is people were still challenging it. We find for Chazal that they were challenging the authenticity of David and the marriage to Bathsheba and the yichus of Shlomo. And the final step to remove that challenge didn't take place until the Beis HaMikdash was built. And at the time of the building of the Beis HaMikdash, the gates of the Beis HaMikdash closed. And they couldn't get the gates to open. They couldn't enter. And they said all kinds of tfilos, and su sharm l'sheichem v'inosu pischei olam, and it didn't help. And until Shlomo said, Bavur David avdecha, al tashay p'nei mishichecha, the gates did not open. So at that point it became clear that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had forgiven David, and that he supported David, and everything was proper. But obviously, if it was necessary to make this display, there were still plenty of people who were challenging it. It wasn't so obvious that it was Mei Hashem Ha'isazos. But this was the argument that Adoniel presented to Bathsheba. And again, as we mentioned, he still doesn't reveal his request. And he's waiting Rishus, and he's acting very humble. And she says, go ahead, tell me your request. Vayomer, and he said, Imri na l'shlomo ha'melech, please say to Shlomo ha'melech, again, Lashon Bakasha, na, ki lo yoshev es p'nayach, he won't turn you aside. Right, this is his excuse for coming to Bathsheba. He's saying, look, he's angry at me, you know, maybe he won't give me my request, not because it's dangerous, not because anything wrong with it, but, you know, he doesn't like me, he's angry at me, he's not going to do what I want, but you, he'll answer, you, he'll give it to. Let me give to me Avishag the Shunamis as a wife. Now there is a, and we're going to follow through the rest of the argument according to the different Malachim. Lefi Pashup Shat, he's simply asking, please go and intercede on my behalf. The Kliyakar is Medayik from the Pasuk, and he suggests that he was asking Bathsheba not to mention that it was my idea. Says Imri Na, so you should say to Shlomo HaMelech, as if it was your idea. Because if someone knows the same idea, if someone knows it's my idea, he's not going to give it to me, he's angry at me, he doesn't like me. But if it's your idea, he may listen. So part of the strategy, according to the Kli Yakar, was that Bathsheba should come and say as if it was her own idea. If you look in the Pasuk later, when Bathsheba does approach Shlomo, she doesn't mention a word about it. She does say it as if it's her idea, at least if you take the Pesukim as the entire story. Other Mepharshim learned that the Pasuk is Mekatzer, doesn't say the whole conversation. But if you say that the Pasuk does say the whole conversation, it's exactly what happens. So that was also part of his strategy, in the hopes of keeping Shlomo Melech off guard. It didn't work, because Shlomo figured out that it was Adoniyahu, as we'll see later when we come to that Pasuk. So Bathsheba agrees. Pasuk Yerches, Vatomer Bathsheba, Tov, good. Anochi Adab Elech HaMelech, I will speak to you to the king. Why does she say Tov? So again, Mepharshim suggests that Bathsheba thought it was a good idea for Shlomo. This was good for Shlomo because it's what I guess in modern terminology we would call appeasement. If you give Adoniyahu what he wants, then he'll be friends with Shlomo and you eliminate a potential enemy. So let's appease Adoniyahu by giving him Avishag and we don't have to worry about him anymore. All right, it's become somewhat unpopular term, appeasement, because, you know, certainly the history of World War II and current history, what goes on when you appease implacable enemies, it doesn't work very well. And of course, it wouldn't have worked very well with Adoniyahu either. But, which Shlomo understood, and he didn't exactly appease Adoniyahu. But, we should understand that there is a place for such a strategy. And it's not completely out of the lexicon. It's not something that should always be rejected out of hand. And in fact, we see no less a person than Yaakov Avinu did exactly that with Esav. Right? When he met Esav coming back from Lavan, he sent him a gift. He was very humble. He bowed down to him. He spoke very nicely to him. This was appeasement. But from Yaakov, we could learn the parameters of when appeasement is appropriate. First of all, it's only appropriate when you don't have the upper hand, when you can't affect another strategy. I mean, he was preparing for a mukhama, says, if you look at it, he's preparing for a defensive mukhama. How did he prepare for mukhama? He divided into two camps so that if Esav attacks one, the other could escape. So that's not a strategy for victory. So clearly, in military terms, of course, Nisim could always happen. But the Ishtadlus has to follow military terms. And military terms, Esav had the upper hand and Yaakov could not win. So then you have to appease. The truth is, you know, there's a pasuk which has, of course, been distorted by other religions, but we won't get into that, that says, Yitein lemakeu lechi, yispa cherpa ula yirachem. In Eicha, says you should turn your cheek to the one who is hitting it, be satisfied with your humiliation, maybe Hashem will have mercy. But read through the end of the parak and you'll see how the parak ends up. Tir dolf the af v'tash midem, chase them in anger and destroy them, mitach ha-shemei ha-shemayim, from under the heavens. So what happened? Here you're saying, let them hit you, and now you're saying, destroy them. The answer is, when you can't destroy them, then instead of just getting all upset and futile type of resistance, you have to let them hit you. Hope Hashem will have mercy. But if Hashem gives you the ability, then you destroy them. You have to understand evil, and you have to destroy it. But there's a place for impeasement where you can't destroy it. Where you're not in a position to destroy evil, then you got to work with it. The second thing I think we learn from Yaakov Avinu is that it has to be short term. It's not a long-term way of life. You do it and separate. Because Esau said, listen, I'll walk back with you. I'll accompany you back. I'll leave some men. No, please don't do me any favors. You go home, and one day, I'll manage to meet you in Seir. Say, Chazal, what does that mean? When Mashiach comes. So as a short-term strategy, appeasement could be effective. But as a long-term strategy, it doesn't work. So there is a place for appeasement, and Bathsheba was not completely out of line in thinking such a thing, but you have to know the situation, you have to know your enemy, you have to know whether this could be a short-term benefit, and then you could separate and go your own way, or you're going to be stuck with this enemy forever, and you have to know what your position is. Shlomo didn't need to appease Adoniyahu. He had the power. And he understood if Adoniyahu is still fighting for the throne, then appeasement is not really going to work, and therefore you have to take action. But this was what Bathsheba thought. It sounded like a reasonable argument. Who could even dream of fighting the throne when it's clear and obvious it's Min HaShemayim? And she thought that it would make peace between Shlomo and Adoniyahu, so she wanted to do it. So she goes immediately to the king. Vatavo Bathsheba el HaMelech Shlomo l'daber lo Adoniyahu. So Bathsheba goes to the king to speak to him about Adoniyahu. Vayakam HaMelech likrasa. The king got up to meet her. Vayishtachul and bowed to her. Vayeshev al kisan, he sat on his throne. Vayosem kisei la'em HaMelech, and he placed a throne for the chair for the mother of the king. Vateshev liyamina, and she sat by his right hand side. So Shlomo treated Bathsheba with great kavod. I don't think we have time to get into it now, but a question is raised whether a king is allowed to do this. Right, Melech shemachu al kavado en kavado machu. A king does not have the right to be mochel his kavod, and for a king to bow down to somebody else, one could argue that it's not kavod for the king. He's been Elamites his mother for good. So does a king have the right to be mochel on his kavod for his parents? Now, usually it doesn't happen with the father, because if the father was still alive, he would be the king. But it could happen. Shaul was made king. His father was not king. I don't know if his father was alive or not. But, so is there a din of kibud av v'aim that, so to speak, supersedes the din of kavod hamelech? Does a king have the right to be mochel on his kavod in order to be mekayim kibud av v'aim? Okay, very good point. And actually, this is discussed by the Achronim, this Gemara in Makkos. Of course, bowing down to Hashem, we can understand more easily, because Hashem has a higher rank than the king. So for the king to bow to a higher authority is not a plesis and kavod hamelech. Well, where does a father and mother fit in? So there is an argument to be made that the father and mother also represent the Shekhinah, and there are chazal to that effect, that being mechabed your parents is like being mechabed the Kadosh Baruch Hu. And if that's the case, then we wouldn't have a problem bowing down to the king. So we'll get into that in a little more detail, Amir Hashem, next week.